Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 47. I'm recording it on Wednesday, November 19th, 2008. The PE10 level today is 15. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The title of this podcast is Rational Investing. It's an attitude, not a program. The purpose of this podcast is to give a little more description of the rational investing model of understanding how stock investing works. That's the model I talk about on all the podcasts and on all the articles at the site. And I always give a short description. I always say that it's an alternative to the passive investing model, which is the dominant model of today. And the passive investing model says that is rooted in the efficient market theory. And the passive investing model says there is no need to change your stock allocation when prices get to insanely dangerous levels. Rational investing says just the opposite. Rational investing rejects the efficient market theory, and rational investing says you must change your stock allocation when prices get to dangerously insane levels. You must try to protect your assets from the losses you'll experience in a price crash if that is inevitable when stock prices get too high. That's the short description, but I felt that since I'm always talking about this model, I should devote a podcast to explaining in a little more detail what it's all about. And I should start by making two distinctions. One, the title of the podcast is it's Rational Investing. It's not an attitude. It's an attitude, not a program. There is an investing strategy that I also talk about at the website and sometimes on the podcast. That's valuation-informed indexing. Valuation-informed indexing is a more specific thing than rational investing. Valuation-informed indexing is essentially just indexing, which was made famous by John Bogle, founder of the Vanguard Fund. When you buy an index, you're buying a broad group of stocks, not any one particular company. So the fate of your stock investment is tied to the fate of the U.S. market as a whole. And I think indexing is wonderful because it allows you to achieve a high level of diversification at very low cost. And it doesn't require any research. So it's a simple approach to invest. It's tailor-made for the typical middle-class investor. But I don't at all agree with the conventional approach to indexing, which is a passive approach. Under the conventional approach, you don't change your stock allocation when prices change. You just stick with the same stock allocation at all different price levels. So valuation-informed indexing is just has a variation where instead of investing passively, you do make changes in your allocation. So valuation-informed indexing came first. Basically, my thinking on investing started with my post to the Motley Fool board in May of 2002, pointing out the errors in the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, the retirement studies. And then, as we did research showing that those studies are indeed analytically invalid, and as we saw the reaction of community members to those findings, I started to realize that, whoa, we've got a tiger by the tail here. There's some real problems with our understanding of how stock investing works. And so the first effort was to disprove the old school studies, and then the second effort was to create analytically valid safe withdrawal rate studies, and the fruit of that work is the Retirement Risk Evaluator, a calculator at my website. But after we did that, the obvious question was, well, if we can predict returns in order to calculate the safe withdrawal rate, can't we predict returns in a more general way? Can't we just predict stock returns not only for retirees but for investors who are not ready for retirement? And of course the answer is we can. And so that effort led to the stock return predictor, another calculator at my website. And once you have the stock return predictor in place, it's a logical follow-up to just say, how should people engage in indexing? Obviously, they shouldn't always stick with the same stock allocation when the value proposition of stocks is changing dramatically over time. So the logical thing to do is to think through. When should people change their allocations? How much should they change them? And a lot of the articles at the website were aimed at answering those sorts of questions. But at some point, even that didn't take things far enough, because coming up with a new way to index gives people an alternate way to invest, a way that I think is superior to the conventional approach to indexing. But there was still this remaining question of why the hostility. We saw a lot of people who were thrilled by these ideas, very excited by them, and a lot of people who contributed to them. To be sure, I don't at all intend to say that I was the certainly not the sole person who developed these ideas. There were hundreds of community members that made constructive contributions. But there were also a number of community members who were hostile to any discussion of the flaws of the conventional approach to indexing, or of the flaws of passive investing in general, or the flaws of the old school safe withdrawal rate studies. And that I saw as a very strange phenomenon. And as I took these ideas to different discussion boards, I found that it wasn't an isolated phenomenon. It wasn't something that happened only in one place. It was a fairly generalized phenomenon. You see, I really saw it everywhere I've taken these ideas, to different degrees, to be sure. But it's a real thing. And even it's even present among investing experts, quote-unquote experts. People like Scott Burns. Scott Burns is a columnist at the Dallas Morning News. He's written three columns making reference to the new school safe withdrawal rate research done by John Walter Russell. John's website is early-retirement-planning-insights.com. John has done all the research for these, you know, that is the engine for these calculators I'm making reference to. And Scott Burns gave, you know, three different columns he made reference. But I engaged in some correspondence with Scott, and ultimately, I think it would be fair to say, he became somewhat hostile in some of his comments. He made a comment at one time saying, my approach, he said that I added a new layer of understanding to the safe withdrawal rate issue, which is a kind thing to say. But then he said that my approach is catastrophically unproductive. I think that's borderline hostile. And, you know, what he means by my approach, I think it's clear. My approach is to say that the old school studies are analytically invalid. So Scott was not happy with that. So at some point, I was driven as a result of these discussions to saying, well, what is the problem here? Why is it, you know, valuation-informed indexing is all to the good. It's impossible for me to understand any way in which it could be a bad thing. Same thing with the retirement risk evaluator. It's all to the good. It's a tool that didn't exist before. Some people don't think these tools have value. They're obviously free not to use them. But other people think they have great value and would love to use them. And yet there's this group that is bound and determined to stop anyone, anywhere on the internet, from hearing about these tools or these ideas or these strategies. Why? Why would discussion of what the historical data says about how to invest effectively cause hostility, cause anger, cause hate? That blew my mind. That absolutely blew my mind. I never anticipated such a reaction. I did anticipate it among a couple of people who I knew in my discussion board community who had a reputation as abusive posters. I was not surprised that a couple responded that way. But the width and breadth of this reaction stunned and amazed me. And so what I came to believe is that reaction is the real problem. That reaction is the reason we have passive investing in the first place. And that reaction is the reason we have the old school safe withdrawal rate studies, the failed retirement studies. That's the reason we have these things, is that investors have an emotional stake in doing the wrong thing. Now, that's a shocking claim. I think it's a true claim. I think I can back it up all the way down the line. And it is an extremely important claim, because if that claim is true, if that claim I am putting forward is true, then we can't become good investors. We can't become effective investors until we solve the problem. Because the situation we have is that we can generate thousands of wonderful insights that would help us all to become more effective investors, help us all to achieve retirement early in life. But what good will it do us if we're filled with anger and hate and arrogance and hostility? We're not going to read the insights. We're not going to make use of them. We're going to blind ourselves to them. So I came to the conclusion we had to deal with this problem. And rational investing is a work in progress. It's not a complete concept at this time. It's something that I am trying to develop as we go, and recording these podcasts is part of the development process. But as I talk through these issues, I think through the issues, and I learn more. And I'm of course always open to input from other community members that are willing to take time out of their day to help us all learn. So rational investing is a work in progress. It's not a complete concept. But the idea of rational investing, it's essentially, if you really wanted to just state it in the most simple terms imaginable, it's what I thought investing was before I learned about the hostility that is at the core of the passive investing model. I had always assumed, I'm no investing expert. I am I don't want to go through my whole history, but I certainly never aspired to be an investing expert before I got involved in the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate. What I knew about investing was what I needed to learn to put my own retirement plan together, nothing more. But that experience, I had always assumed that people were trying to understand investing to the best of their ability. And if you go on the internet and you plug in various terms related to investing, you'll find thousands and thousands of articles. There's new articles being generated every day on investing. How many are generated in a day? It's the number must be in the hundreds. There are so many blogs and magazines and websites and newspapers. The number's probably in the thousands each day. And it just makes me feel so sad to think that all of this human energy is being devoted to understanding the subject. And of course, that's a good thing. We want to understand investing. It's an important topic. But so much of it is directed not at learning how to invest more effectively, but to block out knowledge. That's the core idea here. That what I discovered in the discussions during the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate is that investing is largely an emotional endeavor, not a rational endeavor. And therefore, investors become emotionally attached to certain ideas or certain strategies. And all that they want is not to have those ideas questioned. They want to feel secure. They want to feel, I did the right thing. They don't want to have to feel that they made a mistake. They don't want to feel that they ever gave bad advice and hurt other people. What they want is to think they did the right thing, even if it means they'll suffer huge losses of 50% of their life savings. People are perfectly willing to suffer a loss of 50% of their life savings if only it means they will never have to admit they were wrong about passive investing. As incredible as it sounds, that statement is true. The post archives of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate show that to be true. beyond any reasonable doubt whatsoever. People are willing to suffer massive financial losses rather than admit that they were wrong about an investing strategy. So, of course, the safe withdrawal rate is a mathematical calculation. So the thing we're talking about, it's not a question where there's some sort of difference of opinion, legitimate difference of opinion. It's a mathematical calculation, for heaven's sakes. Anyone who wants to can calculate the safe withdrawal rate. It's the historical data is publicly available information. And yet, there are thousands of people who have been exposed to discussions, and they've seen the arguments, they've seen the data. They know on some level of consciousness that the old school studies are wrong, and they know that if they plan their retirements based on them, they will suffer consequences, but they go ahead and do it anyway. They just go ahead and do it anyway. They say, I'd rather, you know, they of course don't say this openly, but what they're implicitly saying is, I would rather suffer a busted retirement than admit that I got something wrong. I would rather suffer a busted retirement than change my thinking on investing at this stage of the game. I can't do it. I can't do it. And they become agitated, and they'll say, we have to ban honest posting. You know, I cannot stand to hear what the historical data says. It drives me crazy. How many people have told me that? The number is in the hundreds. And they can't all be pretending. You know, if it were two people, you could say they're playing a game. It's too many people. And too many intelligent people. And even including big name experts. We've interacted with a number of big name experts who obviously they respond somewhat differently than internet goons. They don't engage in, you know, obvious forms of abusive posting. But they do evidence hostility, anger, indifference, confusion, all these sorts of things. So rational investing is a response to that. I didn't wake up and one day and say, I have some time on my hands. I think I'll invent a new model of understanding how stock investing works. I had no intention of inventing any new models, believe me. It's the last thing on my mind. It was the last thing on my mind back in May of 2002. If I had some free time, I would like to be spending the time promoting the book that I wrote on saving, not investing. I have never spent hardly any time whatsoever promoting that book. I don't even have a picture of the cover of the book up at my website, and I published it over three years ago, July of 2005. I haven't had time. I spend all of my time exploring investing because I think these issues are so important. They're huge. The implications are just huge. But the point is, I did not go into this with the intent of discovering a new model of investing. But when I saw the failings of the passive investing model, which is the dominant model of today, the advice that you read, you know, about investing you hear it on television or the radio, or you see it in newspapers or websites. Most of it, 80-90%, is influenced by the passive investing model, by the efficient market theory, which is the intellectual framework for the passive investing model. So, rational investing is a reaction to that. So, it is not a program. Valuation-informed indexing is, you could reduce it to a program if you wanted to. You could reduce it to, you know, to a certain number of strategic steps that I advocate that people take. But rational investing is much more fluid concept. And the concept is, if you really want to just be basic about it, is this: I'm trying to invent what I thought existed long before I came on the scene. I had always assumed that investors were trying to do their best to obtain high returns at low risk. They were trying to make effective use of their money. They were trying to secure their financial futures. They were trying to either finance an age 65 retirement, or in some cases, if they were more ambitious, they were trying to finance an early retirement. I just assumed that to be true. And what I have found is it is not true. It is not true. The emotion that's involved in the investing project is dominant. I would, my estimate is that 70% of the investing game is getting your emotions under control. 70%, and only 30% is this intellectual process of determining where to put your money and when to change your allocation and that sort of thing. 70% is emotional, 30% intellectual. And if you look at the investing literature, it's quite the opposite. I'd say 90% of the investing literature is on the intellectual aspects of investing and 10% on the emotional aspects. So it's totally out of whack. And I am trying to do what I can, what little I can, to address that discrepancy. And that's what rational investing is, an attempt to put into effect what I thought already was the case, that investors, so rational investing, for example, doesn't give a list of rules and say, invest it, you should do this, you should do A, B, C, because first of all, I don't necessarily know what A, B, and C would be. I have some suggestions, but that's all they are. But even if I knew, even if I had some you know, cosmic powers and I could tell you, do A, B, C, I don't think that would be a good thing to do, because our understanding of what works changes over time. So there are no final rules. And this is one of the big errors of the passive investing model. One of the big errors of the passive investing model is, at some point, I think that the beginnings of the development of the passive investing model, it was a good thing. And people tried to codify it. They thought they had developed some insights, and they jumped to conclusions. And they said, oh, it's you know, this is how it works. We cannot question it from this point forward. And they got locked into some things, where locked into some fallacies. And so I want to avoid that. Rational investing in every way is reactive to passive investing. So the idea is to avoid those mistakes, to keep it open, to say, even if we feel strongly that such and such is so, we should remain open to the other point of view. Try not to shut that down. So for example, if there's anything if there's a principle of rational investing that is rock solid, obviously the core principle that is rock solid is that valuations affect long-term returns. That's the driving force of the rational investing model. But the rational investing model argues that we should remain open to the arguments made by passive investors, that we should not shut them down the way they have shut rational investing down. So at my website, I welcome participation by advocates of passive investing. They are not banned. We do not have any bans on honest posting at passionsaving.com. So that's just one example of how rational investing is the opposite of passive investing. But rational investing is more an attitude than it is a program. There are elements of a program to it. There are principles that I can state, and I'll try to get to some of those. But and it will develop more over time. But what makes it different, what is characteristic of the rational investing model, is that it is more an attitude. It's an attitude of wanting to learn, and my thinking is that if you want to learn about investing, you'll do fine. If you want to learn, and if you rein in your negative emotions, the things that make you dogmatic, the things that make you angry, the things that make you hostile to new ideas, if you rein that stuff in, the information is there. It's we live in an information age. There's more information on the internet than any of us can ever hope to cope with. So getting the intellectual problem solved is just not a problem. It's available to us. But we need to open up our minds enough to let it in. And that is where our energy should be directed. The premise of rational investing is that is where we need to direct our energies. So instead of trying to solve intellectual puzzles, we should be directing our energies to figuring out how do we rein in our negative emotions so that when others solve the intellectual puzzles for us, we'll be open to hearing what they have to say. Rational investing is an attitude, not a program. Now, as I was thinking this one over in my head, I was thinking over this podcast last night as I was drifting off to sleep, and perhaps you've had the experience where I often have this when I'm drifting off to sleep. I sort of have conversations in my head. You know, I think about things, whatever's on my mind at the time. And I thought about a couple things about how it's curious. You know, we all have histories, and it's always curious how, you know, certain people come up with certain ideas. Why is it that certain people, you can look at two people and you'll think, you know, they I don't know, maybe demographically they're similar, they have similar jobs or similar income levels, and you would think that they would go off in the, you know, sometimes even brothers, you think they'd go off in the same direction. But something in their personality or something in their life experience causes them to take very different paths. And I can think, as I was laying in bed last night, I thought of several experiences in my life that I think reveal something about how it is that I came over time to become interested in developing this new model of how stock investing works, something that I never would have imagined would be a project that I would have taken up in the course of my lifetime. And personal stories, personal narratives are very much a part of the rational investing model. The whole idea of the rational investing model is we do look at things like historical data to find out how stock investing works. So there is, you know, that in that sense, rational investing has similarities to passive investing. But we never rely solely on the numbers. A rational investor never relies solely on the numbers, because we're always trying to be aware of the emotional side. And so listening to personal narratives is very much a part of this model. You know, it's the reason why the famous example of this is when I go on discussion boards and I quote song lyrics, and some of the passive investing dogmatists, they just go nuts. You can't quote a song lyric in a discussion of investing. This is serious. You can't discuss a song lyric. But I think you can. I think we can learn through song lyrics and through jokes. I think a sense of humor is critical to investing success, because a sense of humor reins in those negative emotions. It gives you perspective. That's really what a sense of humor is. It's perspective. And when you can strengthen your ability to keep perspective, you don't get wrapped up in this feeling that, oh, I can never admit I'm wrong. You could just laugh at yourself. You could say, oh, well, you know, what a goof I am that I didn't see that. Huh. I thought safe withdrawals were the same at all value. Oh, what a joke. Of course they're not the same. Of course valuations affect long-term returns. Duh. You know, why didn't I think of that? You need a sense of humor to let these things in. And something that can really help are stories, personal narratives. So I felt that I should do a podcast on this question, and I should relay some of these personal narratives from my own life. And the first one that came to mind, and I can't give much detail, this was so long ago. I'm 52 today, and this happened probably when I was 7 or 8. It's very young. And I was at the breakfast table with my mother and my father, and my younger brother was probably there. And you know, I think I used to eat cereal, you know, cold cereal most mornings, probably Lucky Charms. I was probably eating Lucky Charms, and my father was probably eating Shredded Wheat. That was his favorite cereal. My mother, I don't think she usually ate breakfast, my recollection. She was having coffee. And my parents got into a discussion of investing. And my father, now it's really very interesting. It's really very interesting how these things tie together, how the elements of a life tie together. But my father, he liked stock investing. He believed in it. And he was a big follower of John Bogle. I don't know whether when I was very young, I'm not sure if John Bogle was even on the scene yet. So it may be at this time he was not. But later in life, my father picked a lot of individual stocks too. He had a stockbroker, so you know, in those days, though, that's what people did. But as he got older, he became a convert to Bogle's ideas. My father was a big believer in John Bogle, and my father tried to get me to save money when, you know, after I got a job and I left home and so forth. And I was not a saver. You know, I became a saver later in my life. But in the early years, I was not. And my father would try to explain to me why it's important to save money. And, you know, he didn't have a whole lot of success. But when he did, he would say, you know, and then invest your money in Vanguard, you know. And I didn't even know why. But all I knew was my dad was a big believer in Vanguard. And when I did finally save a little money, and I had a little money to invest, I did indeed put it in Vanguard funds. And there's a guy over in the Goon Central board, Schroeder, and he brings up the Wellesley Fund all the time. He's always arguing passive investing's the way to go. And he says, oh, the Wellesley Fund has a good long-term track record. And I don't think Schroeder knows that I've only owned, in my recollection, I've only owned two mutual funds in my life. And one of them was the Wellesley Fund. And the other one, I think, was Windsor. You know, I think they were both funds with a W. That's really all I remember. I don't remember the names of the funds or what they were in or anything, but I recollect them both being funds with a W in the name. So I'm pretty sure it was Wellesley and Windsor. But really, all I had to go by, I had zero interest in investing. And my dad said, you know, if you're looking for something to invest in, you invest in Vanguard. You know, he loved it that Bogle would cut cost. You know, that was a big thing to my dad, and so Bogle was made for my dad. There's no question about it, and that's, I find that very interesting, because in these podcasts, I'm on the one hand, I'll say I like Bogle, and I do a lot of Bogle stuff. I think is great, and on the other hand, you know, the rational investing model is trumping Bogle. You know, valuation informed indexing is taking Bogle's indexing concept and taking it to the next stage. It's indexing that works in the real world. So there's a sense in which I'm trumping Bogle, and boy, the Freudians, you know, the Freudians would have a field day. They'd say, oh, he's trying to go beyond his father. You know, his father was a conventional Bogle guy, and he's going to follow his father's footsteps, but then go one step beyond, you know. So I don't know if you can take that sort of thing too seriously, but I do think that my dad's respect for Bogle, his affinity for the Bogle philosophy influenced me. And so I've always had, when I started thinking about investing more seriously, trying to understand it, it was Bogle's ideas that were the foundation. So without intending to, I'm just a Bogle type guy. That's where I start from. But of course, when I found errors in these ideas, in the beginning, I didn't take it all that seriously. I just felt, well, it's a mistake. So what? You know, we all make mistakes. But then when I saw the reaction to the mistake, that's what took me on this new path. It's the reaction that caused this. But I find the reaction just stunning. To this day, I'm stunned by it, amazed by it. But my dad, so we were at the breakfast table, and my dad was, you know, they were having some sort of discussion. I assume that stocks were having a hard time or something like that, and my mother was nervous about it. And my mother was saying, oh, you know, invest, it's gambling. She was saying, oh, stock investing is gambling. You never know what's going to happen to your money. And that's sort of my mother's, my mother has a tendency a bit to take sort of a dark view of things. I think that's fair. And a skeptical view. My mother is certainly a skeptic. So she would be skeptical of it and have a somewhat more pessimistic approach. My dad has more of a sunny approach. My dad is more, things will be fine. Don't worry about it. You know, invest for the long run. That's my dad. You know, things will work out. Just don't get all excited. It'll work out. And, you know, he would say, oh, you know, you're investing in American companies. These good companies. These are, you know, you're not investing in some fly-by-night stock. You know, he would have no interest in a fly-by-night stock. He's just steady as she goes kind of guy. And, you know, and they would turn to me. It was a common thing, I think, in these discussions. They would have different points of view, and they would turn to me and sort of as a joke. But they, you know, what do you think, you know? And of course, I know nothing about the subject, and I would always be a diplomat and sort of take half of each person's view. But now, years later, it's very curious that I am endorsing my father's views in that I'm endorsing indexing, I'm endorsing much of the Bogle philosophy, but yet there's a layer there of my mother's views in which I'm taking a skeptical approach to the Bogle philosophy and to indexing, and I'm taking, some would call it pessimistic. I don't think my views are pessimistic, but at the time when stock prices were sky high, I was saying, look, we're going to have a price crash. You've got to protect your assets. And many looked at that and said, oh, Rob is afraid, you know, doom and gloom. He thinks the sky is falling. You know, that's something people would have said about my mother. So I do feel, in a way, it's very interesting that I've combined those two viewpoints without intending to. But looking back on it now, I see that that's happened. And I believe, and I think there are a lot of people who, these questions are, oh, they're underneath the surface all the time. What I'm trying to do with the work I do at my website is to get these issues out into the public square, to get people talking about them. I remember there was one time I was at a picnic, and this is, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, something like that. I was at a picnic. And there was a woman, and she came up to me, and, you know, you have this discussion, you know, what kind of work do you do, whatever. And we started talking, and she got very interested in the book I've written and the website and all this sort of thing. And I started telling her about stocks. I said, well, you know, right now I spend most of my time on this investing business, and you'd be amazed, you know. Stock prices were, of course, much higher then. And I'm like, you'd be amazed. You know, investing is really emotional. People get, you tell them what the historical data says and about how stocks perform at these prices. And you wouldn't believe the things people say and do. And she's interested. And so I could tell she was very interested. She clearly had doubts about stocks herself. You could just tell. And so then I gave her my famous quote. I'd said, you know, look, stocks have been at these price levels 3 times in history. And the average drop in price on those 3 occasions is 68%. And I say that on the internet all the time at discussion boards, and I never get any reaction. You know, usually what I get is, I think some people do hear it, but the ones that hear it are afraid to say anything, and others tune it out. And so I never get any reaction. People don't want to discuss it because they're scared. They're either, if they agree, they're scared to speak out. And if they disagree, how can you disagree with a fact? You know, it's not really, they don't disagree. They just don't want to hear it. The ones with the heavy stock allocations didn't want to hear it. But she was interested. Her jaw was hanging open. And I said, well, that's the way it is. That's the way it is. And now later, you know, I went off and talked to some other people, did other things. And then I happened to just be walking by her husband. And, you know, he just sort of made, and I don't want to interpret too much what was in his mind because I don't know, but he made sort of a rueful comment like, I understand, you know, you've been talking to my wife about stocks, you know, and I could just picture this whole thing going on where he's the guy that buys into the passive investing and he thinks you don't have to change your allocation, and his wife, you know, sort of like my father and my mother, you know, that my father just, you know, stay for the long run, it'll be fine. And my mother was saying, oh, stocks are gambling, you know, I don't like putting my money in gambling. And I sensed the same dynamic there, that the woman was uneasy. Probably they had already had discussions where she had said, maybe we should lower our allocation a little bit. Maybe, you know, we don't need 70% in stocks. What if we go to 50, you know? And he didn't like that. He's like, no, you know, stocks for the long run. We got to stay at 70. It'd be a terrible mistake. And here I am, you know, and I'm telling her, oh, yeah, you know, 68% loss. So it was curious. And I just wonder if, I'm sure that it's true, that these kind of conversations are happening. They're happening all over the United States, all over the world, really. But it was sometimes discussed. I remember some threads on our discussion boards where people would say, your investing strategy has to pass the test of, you know, can you explain it to your wife? And, you know, the problem, of course, is if you can't talk about it, you know, nobody can make the case. I mean, what people would say to their wife is they'd say, oh, honey, look, John Bogle, expert, big time expert. He says to stick with it. Don't change your allocation. But then I recall reading a comment. This is just in the past week, and some guy said, I told my wife to lower our allocation at I don't know when. You know, it's a year ago or something. I think it was a year ago. And she thinks I'm a genius now. She's like, oh, you know everything, you know. And of course, to some extent, it was probably just luck. But the point is, most of us aren't thinking through these questions. We've got our whole lives riding on it, our life savings, our hopes for retirement. And most of us haven't thought it through. I can tell. When I discuss with people, most people are just doing what everyone else does. If everyone else says stocks for the long run, passive investing, can't time the market, whatever, then they say, well, I guess that's what I'll do. Even if that's the worst possible thing to do. It's a strange dynamic. And the point of rational investing is it's not to tell people. It's certainly not to tell people don't put your money in stocks. You see, that's what we have today is this mixed up, twisted dichotomy where you have to be in one camp or the other. So you've either got to be the person who says passive investing, never change your allocation, or you're the stock hater. You're the person who says stocks are gambling. I don't want to have money in stocks. And I just can't buy that dichotomy. I think stocks are wonderful, like my dad did. But I also think stocks are gambling, like my mother did. Stocks are gambling. Stocks are, when you buy at fair price, it's not gambling. Because when you buy at fair price, stocks are at fair price today, you may lose your money over 5 years. You may suffer big losses. But in the long term, you're going to see a recovery, in all likelihood. There's no guarantees, but in all likelihood. But when you buy stocks at the prices that applied from 1995 to the first part of 2008, yes, you are gambling. I don't see what else you can call it. The odds were against you. Now, if you put 20% or 30% of your money in stocks, fine. That's not gambling. That's just covering yourself in the possibility that an unlikely statistical possibility comes through. But if you went with a heavy stock allocation in those years, you were gambling. That is definitely my opinion. And the advisors that were telling people not to change their stock allocation were urging people to gamble with their retirement money. I think that is an absolutely fair statement. And I don't think they want to acknowledge it. I don't think they want to come to terms with it. But the odds of a good result were so slim that it was gambling. It was gambling. So my mother wasn't wrong, but my mother, in my opinion, my mother had too dark, too skeptical of a viewpoint. My father wasn't wrong. Stocks really are a great investment class, but he had too sunny of a viewpoint, too unskeptical of a viewpoint. And I believe that what works for in the long run is a combination of those healthy instincts. I think optimism is a healthy impulse. I think my father's take on it was healthy. But I think skepticism is also healthy. I don't think you have to go with one or the other. And I think we need to have, it's wonderful if in a marriage you have one party to the marriage, one spouse, that takes one viewpoint and the other takes the other. But they need to talk it out so that all the issues get on the table. And of course, in discussion board communities, we need to get all these opinions out on the table. And that's the only way we can come to understand how stock investing works. You see, that's what rational investing is all about. It's not about saying you should have a 56% stock allocation. That's optimal. Oh, no, no. Somebody else will say, no, 33%. Somebody else will say, no, 92%. It's not about telling you what your allocation should be. It's telling you how you should learn what your allocation should be. That you should adopt an open approach and that you should try to use data because data can inform you, but you should never make a fetish out of the data. You should never go solely by data. And you should never buy into experts uncritically because you have to understand that experts are influenced by the fact that most of them are in the stock selling industry. So they can't talk straight. They've got heavy pressures on them. And during wild bull markets, the pressures are intense. Just look at the transcripts of look at the post archives of the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate, and you'll see how intense the pressures are to conform to the viewpoint that prices don't matter. There's an intense desire to shut out the realities, and you need to, if you develop the skill to resist those pressures, sure, you can beat the market. You can beat the market soundly. You can, you know, I love that title I have for an earlier podcast. I know more about investing than John Bogle, and you can too. If you deal with these emotional questions that John Bogle generally does not, and most investing experts of today do not, if you deal with these emotional issues, you sail ahead of these people. You spare yourself these bone-crushing losses, and boy, you have to do the math sometime. Do the math. You know, we've suffered a 45% drop in stock prices over the past 15 months. Do the math on how far ahead you would be if you hadn't suffered that 45% loss. How many years of saving you would add to your portfolio, you know, by not suffering that loss. Well, you can be in the group that doesn't suffer those losses. If you develop these emotional skills, you can study the data from here till doomsday, and it's not going to put you ahead of John Bogle. Unless you have the emotional wherewithal to hear the message of the data. You see, passive investors, they study data. They study data 8 days a week. But the problem is they don't want to hear what the data says. So when they study it, They start taking in the data, and they say, whoa, my tummy's starting to hurt. I don't like what the data's telling me. And then there's a part of their mind that clicks on and says, hey, I know what to do. I know what to do so the data won't look so bad. Ignore valuations. That's the thing causing all the trouble. Just ignore that. And they say, yeah, that would work. Look at this. The safe withdrawal rate is 2%, but if I ignore valuations, it looks like it's 4%. I can retire today, and I can keep my high stock allocation. That's how it works in the real world. It's all about playing games, playing mental games, to trick yourself into believing things that aren't so, to trick yourself into thinking that that high stock allocation that you want to go with can really work, even though it can't. So you don't need an intellect. A lot of people are intimidated by the experts. They think, oh, the experts, they know all these numbers. I don't. I can't compete with them. But you can sail ahead of the experts if you tune into the emotional questions, which are 70% of what determines success. You will need to understand the numbers a little bit, but you won't need any advanced degrees in mathematics to understand them, because I can assure you that Rob Bennett has no advanced degrees in mathematics. I barely got through high school, you know, because of mathematics. I had a good record in a lot of other subjects, but not in mathematics. So if I could learn the mathematics needed to develop, an entire investing model, believe me, you know, in one weekend study, you can learn whatever mathematics you need to learn to be a successful long-term investor. Oh, another little story from my, from my life. I don't know. I was a little bit older. I think I might have been in seventh grade when this happened. Sixth grade, seventh grade, something like that. I had some money. You know, kids didn't have as much money in those days, at least not in my neighborhood. Kids today tend to have a lot. They tend to buy everything they see and everything they want. But I didn't. And of course, I didn't need it. My parents were providing for me, but you know, I think I had an allowance if, you know, I'd clean the basement and my father would give me like a dollar, you know. And I would save up those dollars and I just wanted to buy record albums. That's all I wanted to spend my money on. Or gifts, you know, for Christmas for somebody, something like that. But I had, one time I had about $38 saved up. and it would have gone to, you know, to record albums. And they had this thing called a midwinter festival at our church, our school. And, you know, the money, I'm sure, went to the school or the church. And I got involved in some dice game, you know, craps or something. And, you know, and I lost all the money. And I remember coming back and, you know, my older brother just said, you know, you're a dope, you know. Don't you feel stupid? And, you know, I've never had much temptation to gamble. I think largely as a result of that. My parents used to go to Atlantic City all the time. They'd play the slot machines, and you know, a lot of elderly people did that, and they would take me. They'd take me because, you know, for the company, and they'd treat me to dinner or something. But you know, they'd say, "Oh, here's $5. Play the slot machines," and I was like, "No, you know, take your $5 back, or you know, I'll buy something to eat with it. I'll buy a hot dog with it, but I'm not gonna. I just can't do it. I really can't do it. I just can't develop an interest. I'll play poker because of the social side of it. I love to play poker, but you know, for small amounts of money. But the point is, I'm not a gambler. I'm not a gambler. And I think there's an aversion in my mind to not to stock investing. I love the idea of stock investing. I especially love the idea of long-term stock investing. I think I get that from my dad. I'm repeating myself, but I think there's just something there that in my personality that just likes that. But I hate the idea of gambling my money. I don't like it. And so I think that's one of the things that makes me, when I hear people describe stock investing, there's a part of me that relates to it, that likes it. But there's a part of me that says, no, they're talking about gambling. And then it's a turnoff. As soon as I think they're talking about gambling, it's a turnoff. And there's an incident I can remember. I worked, you know, after I finished school, I worked as a reporter at various newsletters. And back in 1987, you know, we had a big stock crash, a very sudden stock crash, just a couple of days, but stocks fell, you know, an incredible amount in just 2 or 3 days. And I was covering Capitol Hill, and I had this, you know, I had a computer there at my desk. It wasn't, I didn't have a closed office. I was like in a bullpen sort of situation. And I had a computer, and we had the Reuters newswire, and it was right next to my desk, and it would, you know, I'm sure today it comes in on computer, but it used to come out, you know, and it would be this machine, and it made a lot of noise. And whenever there was an update in the news, you know, we would get the Reuters wire. Now today, anybody can get it, you know, but in those days, that wasn't so. Only news organizations had it. And there was this guy, and I think there were two or three of them. They'd come over whenever the stock prices came out, and they'd look at the Reuters wire, you know, and you couldn't get it on your computer in those days. There was no, I don't think there even was an internet, or if there was, it was very limited. And so they were, they would come over every day, and, you know, they'd be doing jigs, you know, because stock prices were going up, and they were rich, and blah, blah, blah. And I had no money in the market and no interest. I had no savings and didn't care to. And so I wasn't jealous of them, but I was sort of amused that they would come by. But see, there was something in my mind that always felt, you know, it was fine if they were, to me, it was like a game. You know, they were playing a game. But I always had a part of my mind that was that viewed what they were doing as gambling. Not because I viewed stock investing as gambling, but the way they did it, their attitude to it. You see, that's what told me they were gambling. I didn't feel that you had to gamble. But when you did it the way they did it, because I saw the emotion, I just saw how they were giddy about these prices going up. And in my mind, it was just so obvious that if the prices can go up for silly reasons, they can go down for silly reasons. In other words, easy come, easy go. The part of stock investing, which is sharing in a business enterprise, that is real to me. This is in the days when I hadn't read anything about investing. I always felt that it was real. But this idea of getting giddy about, you know, some ridiculous bull market, that always was a turnoff to me because I always could see the other side. If prices go up irrationally, they can go down irrationally. And it just strikes me now, you know, years later, that I just always felt that instinctually. And I remember, so what happened in the 87, you know, the prices just, you know, they went down. It was 25% or something. I don't remember what it was. It was a huge amount, like in one day. And, of course, they were sick. You know, they were sick. And, but I remember there was a woman that came by, and she was a manager of one of the publications. And, I was sort of laughing. You know, I was sort of laughing about, I think I might have been on the phone to somebody or something, and I was telling them about it, and I was sort of laughing, and I wasn't laughing at them. I was not, you know, it would have been inappropriate if I had been, you know, sharing joy or something in their misfortune, and that wasn't what was happening, but I was just laughing at the situation. To me, it was all a game, and so it was sort of like, you know, one day the game goes your way, and one day the game goes the other way, and obviously you've got to accept that that's going to happen if you're playing the game. So I was just sort of laughing, and she was like, she probably had lost money too. I didn't, you know, and she said, you know, what are you laughing at? And I was like, oh, you know, they're all talking about these stock prices, you know, and I just, my tone was very glib. Again, not because I was laughing at them. I was laughing at the situation. But it strikes me that, you know, that's a consistent theme in my thinking about stocks, that I don't like this side of stock investing. This, I think of it as a dark side, that stock investing to a lot of people becomes a game. And I don't want it to be a game. I want to be invested in stocks. I love the idea of making a return on my money so that I can get financial freedom, so that I get money, you know, that I didn't have to work for. But I hate becoming a gambler. I resent it. I think it's degrading. You know, again, if you gamble poker, see, I don't mind gambling poker because I'm doing it for the social interaction. So I don't consider that degrading. But standing there at a slot machine, pulling it and having my money, if you do it for fun, like my parents did, it's fine. You know, they did it. They were older and there weren't a lot of other things they could do. So I felt it was basically healthy. You know, gave them something to do, and they made friends. They made friends on the bus and all that sort of thing, and all that can be fine. But the gambling element of it, and I love to go to the racetrack. I love to bet on horses because, you know, but when I go to the racetrack, I like to go and have dinner. You know, I like to sit there and have dinner and sort of watch the races, and you talk, you know, with whoever you go with. You know, you look through the program, you sort of make jokes, you pick a horse. All that I like, but I don't like the sick part of gambling where you're emotionally caught up in it and you really don't want to lose your money. See, to me, that's degrading. It's I don't know. It's like, you know, the way I say it, I guess, is that you lose a piece of yourself. You know, if it gets to matter too much, if the numbers, you know, that you're going to lose are going to hurt, then you shouldn't be doing it. And stock investing can become that. And so whenever you hear me speaking out sternly, and I do this all the time, against passive investing, that's where that comes from. I don't like turning investing into gambling. And that's what passive investing does. Because the market is not one thing. When the market is fairly priced, it's all you're buying when you buy a stock is a share of U.S. productivity, a share of the productivity of U.S. businesses. But when stocks are priced three times fair value, like they were at the top of the bubble, a third of your money is going into the purchase of shares in the productivity of the U.S. economy, and two-thirds is going into nonsense, just, you know, nonsense price buildups that have no substance. You're gambling with two-thirds of your money. You're hoping, you know, that someone's going to buy those shares. Someone's going to gamble more than you did, and you're going to make out. You know, you're going to get lucky. You're going to get hot. I find it offensive. It insults my intelligence to think that investing could work that way. Passive investing argues that prices don't matter. Prices don't matter. If you're not changing your allocation, you're implicitly saying prices don't matter. And how can they not matter? Prices determine whether stock investing is investing or gambling. And when you're putting a large percentage of your money into stocks that are wildly overpriced, you are gambling with your retirement. And you can see how worked up I get about it. Whenever you hear me getting worked up, that's where it's coming from. This gambling aspect of investing is a turnoff. So what is what's going on, and I think it's very curious, is that what I've done and the work I've done at the website is to take investing, and what I love about Bogle is he came up with a simple way to invest so that the middle class person doesn't have to study all these stocks, I don't really want to spend a lot of time, frankly, on investing. I want to live my life, but I do want to get decent returns. And Bogle gave us a way to do that by his creation and promotion of indexing funds. He gives us a way to invest without having to spend time studying the annual reports and the, balance sheets and all this sort of thing. For people that like that, great, do it. I think investing like Warren Buffett, where you study the balance sheets, that's the way to go if you like it. But if you don't like it, I think you need a simple way, but a way that is safe and a way that provides decent returns. I don't think you can bury your money, in the yard and you can't invest in money markets to be safe. I think you've got to be in stocks, but you've got to do it in a way. So Bogle started a revolution. He gave middle-class investors a way to invest, a way to tap into the productivity of U.S. businesses in a way that is simple and effective and reasonable, sensible, a long-term strategy. But then he ruined it by saying, oh, you don't need to look at price. That was his big mistake, saying you don't need to look at price. Because when you don't look at price, you're gambling. As soon as you say those words, I am a passive investor, I don't look at price, what you're really saying, what my ears hear, is I'm a gambler. I should be going to Gamblers Anonymous. I'm gambling with my retirement money. So, what's really happened is my reaction to this sort of thing has caused me to try to develop a model of investing that has all the merits of Bogle's approach, but that is not gambling, that takes the gambling out of Boglehead investing. And the gambling comes in because of passive investing. That's what makes it gambling, that you ignore price, that you don't change your allocation based on price. So I'm going to have additional podcasts down the road where I define rational investing in greater detail than I have here. But the starting point to understand what rational investing is to understand it's an attitude, not a program. There are principles that follow from that attitude. Obviously, as I say, one principle is going to be we're going to look at valuations because we don't want to be gamblers. So we're, of course, going to look at valuations. But another principle is going to be we're never going to be dogmatic. We're not going to shut out the passive investors. If someone comes along and wants to make a case for not changing our allocation or for not changing it as much or, whatever it happens to be, we want to hear them out because that's emotionally healthy. It's emotionally healthy to expose yourself to different viewpoints because two things can happen. One, they could be right. And if they're right, you want to learn that. You want to learn that you made a mistake and you want to correct it. Two, they could be wrong. And in that case, you will have to craft an argument to show that they're wrong. And crafting that argument will help you to understand your own investing strategy better. And understanding your own investing strategy better will make you more effective as an investor. Because if you understand it, you'll be able to stick with it through the hard times. That's what you need to do to be successful. That's what you need to do to not only talk the buy and hold talk like the passive investors do, but to walk the buy and hold walk as rational investors aim to do. So view this podcast as an introduction to the rational investing model. Little detail, but I think the ideas that I'm putting out in sketchy form in this podcast, I view them as being significant. It's a big change from what you have heard over the past 20 or 30 years from the passive investing enthusiast. I don't say invest in stocks at all prices. I say, yes, invest in stocks. Stocks are wonderful. And yes, invest for the long term. And yes, watch for prices. And yes, consider index funds if you don't like doing lots of research. All that. But don't gamble. Cut the gambling out to the extent possible. Try to be an investor, not a gambler. And you then tap into the good side of investing, the healthy side, the enriching side. And you leave that ugly, nasty stuff that causes the passive investing dogmatist to be so angry and so filled with hate and so filled with contempt and so dogmatic and so narrow. You leave that behind because it's degrading. You know, I'm not willing to sign up for that stuff. And I don't think you should be either. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.